So this is my group.
We're in Champaign.
Yeah, we have two graduate students working with me and one undergrad one. So I have one sort of new result I was going to talk about today. And all this stuff falls generally under the rubric of simulating sort of varieties of Hubbard physics using optical lattices. My group started off primarily focused on simulating quantum magnetism using optical lattices. And that's sort of a long-term goal I can talk about at the end if people have the stamina to sort of listen to that. We got distracted kind of in the meantime to pursue some other things which are a little bit easier. And so those are the things I was going to talk about today. So I chose a title that you saw that's from the condensed matter point of view a little surprising that we've seen something I would call metallic behavior in a system described by the Bose-Hubbard model, but I'll tell you sort of what our point of view is on that. So it's really a transport measurement inspired by people like Philip Phillips and other people at Urbana. One thing the guys in the lab are working on right now is looking at really fine-grained disorder, adding very fine-grained disorder to the to an optical lattice. And so this is something I'll talk about also, and it's really in a regime that no one's been able to reach yet. So I think this is going to be really exciting. And then at the end, like I said, if sort of people feel like continuing to listen, I can tell you how we're going to do quantum magnetism and an optical lattice and what we're building, sort of the tools we're building to make that. So anyways, I was looking at the list of talks that have been given here. So there's sort of not an enormous point, really very important to go through a lot of the introductory material. Let me just comment that sort of the goal of my group is really to realize Dick Feynman's kind of proposal for doing quantum simulation that he first sort of brought up in 1981 down at a conference in Caltech, that sort of the reason he was interested in the idea of quantum computing is that he conjectured that you can make a quantum computer simulate any quantum system, any many-body quantum system, particularly to address the kind of hard problems that we're all interested in. And so the way I restate his proposal is that what quantum simulation is to make a quantum system that you can control and probe perfectly, behave like one you want to study. And so my group right now, we're focused on using atoms with spin and playing with those spin degrees of freedom and atoms that are bosons and trying to realize quantum simulation for sort of 100,000 strongly interacting quantum particles. Okay, let me just make a very, very important comment on what Dick Feynman originally said, that there should be a computer that does exactly the same thing as nature. I really want to qualify what we mean by nature, what physicists mean by nature. And I think the thing to keep in mind is that everything we're going to do using these systems is really simulating certain kinds of models, right? As physicists, you know, if we want to describe a cow using a model and we do theory on a cow, we use the spherical cow model, right? So that's sort of what a physicist really does. We throw away all the parts about the cow that are really hard to understand and things that we think are not important, and we make some very simplified model, which we hope to use to do things like calculate the amount of milk production, the rate of milk production. And if that model, if the phenomenology of that model matches real life, then we say, maybe that spherical cow model has something to do with real life. And that's what I would say physicists do, and that's sort of what we do when we do things like try to come up with models for the high TC superconducting cuprates. This is already a model, this kind of stick model, a ball and stick model of a unit cell on a cuprate. Then we do things like come up with even worse models than this, like the Hubbard model, where we have a bunch of electrons on a lattice hopping around, and they have spin, and then they can interact with each other in a very low temperature, and then they only interact through virtual tunneling processes. And I'll come back at the end to talk about the magnetism that arises out of those virtual tunneling processes. So like I said, what we really do, and this is sort of the theme for my talk, is we study the phenomenology in these models, and then if it matches up, for example, if we saw something like D-wave superconductivity in the Hubbard model, we'd say, maybe this has something to do with the cuprate. That's really what we do, and that's sort of what I would claim a physicist means by nature. Okay, so I work with optical lattices, and again, you guys have probably heard tons of talks about this. So we have, in my group, we're working with a 3D lattice, a cubic lattice right now. The spacing between lattice sites is 406 nanometers. And like I said, I'll talk about at the end sort of the spin degrees of freedom. I'm going to start off talking, forgetting about the spin, and just talking about the fact that these are bosons. We use rubidium-87 atoms transferred into this kind of optical lattice. And I think the sort of exciting thing about this system is that you can really do 1D, 2D, or 3D, depending on how you change your arrangement of laser beams. And there's other very interesting geometries in 2D also that are possible. Okay, and I'll skip that for now. Okay, so the physics I'm going to talk about is, throw that on the floor, is Hubbard model physics. So I just wanted to sort of put up what I mean by the Hubbard model so we can all settle on a common language. The Hubbard model for fermions, we don't actually have fermionic atoms. I'm not working with potassium-40 right now, but I'd like to set up an experiment to do that. It's got a tunneling term, which takes into account the kinetic and potential energy from the underlying periodic potential. That's the hopping term, and it's got an interaction term, and for fermions, you can only have state atoms with states of opposite spin interact and be on the same lattice site. Right now, like I said, I'm working with rubidium-87 atoms, so we have more interaction terms here, interaction terms that can take into account atoms with the same spin being on a lattice site. And I'm going to, later I'll talk about models that involve two states of spin. And so things like the Hubbard model have been, there's conjecture that it can explain things like the high TC cuprates, and the Bose-Hubbard model, things like maybe supersolids, and so that's what these are useful for. And one thing I'll come back to at the end of the talk, and I'll bring up this slide again, is, you know, this is sort of a very suggestive phase diagram for what the cuprates might be like, where we have antiferromagnetism giving rise to D-wave superconductivity, and the kind of magnetism which people think about, Phil Anderson first conjectured, might be kind of happening right here, very exotic spin-liquid states, is something that I'm very interested in, and something we'd like to do is build basically spin-liquid by hand in and off the lattice. I'll talk about that later. What I'd like to focus on now is a result we just have looking at transport in the Bose-Hubbard model. Okay, so let me talk about this result, and I'm curious to get people's sort of feedback on this. And it's something we're writing up into an article right now. Okay, so one of the first things you think about when you have a hunk of stuff, if you're a condensed matter experimentalist, is you hook it up to a power supply and run some current through it. And then you can calculate, or you can measure the conductivity if you sort of know how much current goes through your hunk of stuff when you apply some kind of voltage to it. If you treat the carriers in a superconductor, the charge carriers, as charged 2E bosons, then what we have is something that maybe can be described by the Bose-Hubbard model. And so people have sort of been thinking about charged 2E Bose-Hubbard models for a long time. Back in the 1980s, in some superconducting materials, some thin films, there's some very strange behavior seen. This is data from those experiments. This is from Heinrich Jaeger's data back from 1984, maybe. These are successively thinner films of gallium. So we start with a 15 angstrom film down here, which really does look superconducting. And then as the film thickness was decreased, we saw what looks like metallic behavior, until eventually we saw things that look like insulators. So what I mean by superconducting versus metallic versus insulating is that really what I'm talking about is what's happening to the resistance at zero temperature. Okay, so here it looks like the resistance vanishes at zero temperature, that we call a superconductor. If the resistance is finite at zero temperature, we call that a metal, and if it's infinite, like these curves here, these very thinnest films, then we call it an insulator. And so these materials sort of spurred on a lot of activity, and this is something, for example, my colleague Phil Phillips is really interested in, to see how do we get something like a metal for bosons. Is, for example, there something like a metallic phase in the Bose-Hubbard model? Is a Bose-Hubbard model a good description of something like these thin film superconductors? And how do we sort of construct a model which can describe the system? So does anyone have questions about this before I go on? Actually, you should just interrupt me.
But in these materials, it's not clear that you don't have fermions, right?
Yeah, so, right. I mean, I think what I understand, so again, I think you should remember I'm kind of a hack, okay, so I'm mostly listening to what people tell me. It could be that the superconductivity is destroyed in a way here as you go to thinner films where you have fermions now and there's no gap anymore. The impression I get from condensed matter people is there's sort of belief in here that there's still paired electrons, there's still bosons, and somehow they enter a metallic phase. At least that seems to be some people's point of view, and that's sort of why I'm researching.
So have people tried, for example, doing tunneling and see if there is a gap in this metallic region?
I think so, but this is a little outside my sort of area of expertise. More what got me interested in this is not particularly this data, but just the idea of looking for different kinds of phases, different kinds of transport behavior in the Bose-Hubbard model. Okay. But maybe people can actually inform me, people who know better than I do, about what the belief is here.
probably no consensus, probably more people would tend to believe that there are plenty of unpaired electrons around.
Right. Yeah.
That okay. Would be more likely majority.
Right. So, anyways, we got interested in, for example, Phil Phillips, my colleague, has, he sort of inspired us to go look at transport in an optical lattice again, mostly because he sort of has these ideas about both metal phases in this regime, where you normally think of it as being a mono-insulator. He would claim that it now has some finite conductivity. So anyways, we went and did a measurement. We saw something kind of surprising, which I think is fun. It was sort of inspired by all that stuff I just discussed. But more, let me just tell you what we did. And I think it turned out to be sort of an interesting story. So anyways, in these systems, what we really have is an optical lattice potential. And we have some harmonic confinement on top of it. This harmonic confinement comes from not just the magnetic trap that we weave on, but also the optical dipole trap formed from the optical lattice beams. Okay, so the sort of oscillator frequency associated with this harmonic potential is maybe about 30 hertz. We have our BEC inside this thing, and there's the optical lattice potential on top of it. The BEC is maybe 30 to 40 microns, and remember that space in between sites is 406 nanometers. And we always measure the lattice depth in units of the recoil energy, which is about 170 nanokelvin in the system. Okay, so this is the measurement that we did, sort of inspired by people who just said, well, go look at transport, because it hasn't been done in kind of 3D yet. In fact, no one really looked at this in 3D. There's old work in the 1D Bose, a system that would be described by the 1D Bose-Hubbard model from the NIST group, from Trey Porto's group. But no one's really looked at it in 2D or 3D. Okay, so here's what we did. We start off by making a BEC of rubidium 87 atoms. We transfer it into optical lattice by ramping up this lattice potential very slowly over 100 milliseconds. Then what we do is we give the atoms an impulse, and we start them oscillating back and forth. And they oscillate back and forth because of this external potential, because of this harmonic confinement. So we let that motion evolve freely for up to 200 milliseconds. Then we ramp off the lattice potential in a way that so this band mapping step is an old trick in this business. It ramps off in about 200 microseconds. You should just think about what happens now is it's releasing the atoms from the trap. They fall out of the trap, they expand, and then we get to look at what their velocity was before the release. So they fall to some equilibrium position. If they weren't moving, and if they're moving, they're actually moving up and down in the trap. If they're moving down before release, then they go a little farther. If they're moving up, they don't fall quite as far. Okay, so we get to look at what their velocity was before the release. And this is the kind of behavior that we see. Okay, so what I'm plotting here is data that we take where we actually look at the velocity. So here's the velocity in millimeters per second. These are under a couple different conditions. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at the velocity when we go into different depth lattices and for different temperatures. Something that has not really been done in these systems before is really exploring what's happening as the temperatures vary. So the black dots here are actually the motion of the condensate. So when we release, we can see two component clouds. If we do it at finite temperature, we can see a sort of what looks like a BEC, and we can see a thermal cloud. And we can measure the velocity of each separately, and we can see they're moving independently here. So sometimes at low temperature, and in not too deep lattices, we see them co-moving to begin with. Then this motion kind of damps out of the thermal cloud, and the motion also damps of the BEC component. So the black dots here are the BEC component. This is just data, so that's data taken at 2ER. The temperature there, T over TC, is measured in the magnetic trap. So we do that by just measuring the condensate fraction from images like this. So that's the condensate fraction before transfer into the lattice. And here's data from a deeper lattice at higher temperature, where you can see it looks like the thermal cloud is just not moving at all. And the condensate motion still damps away to zero velocity.
So each of these points is a new condensate released.
Yeah.
Different.
Right. Yeah. So this, the motion is small enough. There's no way we could actually measure it in the trap. So we actually repeat over and over again, destructive measurement every time. That's right. Let me just show you what the sort of data really look like in a movie form, because I think it sort of gives you an idea of what's really going on here. That's actually a movie of that data taken, where you can see the thing that looks like the BEC, the narrow component. Oscillates back and forth, and in this data, the thermal cloud's not moving. Okay, so that's the data that you're seeing. And this band mapping step, what this really does for us is basically let us look at what the quasi-molar distribution is in the lattice. Okay, so that's sort of just representative data of the type that we see. Is anyone lost in terms of how we take data and what this data represents.
And what's the impulse response? You move the overall trap? Or
what we do is we just for a very short period of time, for 7 milliseconds, it's short compared to sort of a lot of this motion, we change the equilibrium position of the cloud by shifting the...
The overall potential.
Well, actually just the center of the magnetic trap. So now you have sort of a funny potential, but that's just, as far as we can tell, it really looks like a rapid impulse.
But you displace many lattice,
Yeah, many lattice sites, and then, but before it can really move, we move what should be the equilibrium position back. And so basically, it really looks like the thing starts from rest with an impulse.
But from many lattice contacts away from the minimum?
No, it starts moving in, so what it actually does is it really looks like an impulse. It starts at the minimum. It starts with a velocity. And it just starts removing from the equilibrium position. It's a little bit different than the way this was done in this group to study 1D transport.
Why you have window from 100 to 150 with no points?
Oh, this is just a trick for taking the least amount of data to get the best signal to noise. Actually, this is sort of a well-known trick amongst experimentalists. You don't actually have to fill in. If you want to measure things, the actual thing we're particularly interested in here is the damping rate. This is an old trick which a lot of people know. If you want to get high quality data without taking too much data to measure the damping rate, you actually don't need to measure continuous curves. We have lots of data where we do, but then the graduate students get tired of taking
it. So how to determine the temperature in the room with the lattice?
So we don't actually measure the temperature in the lattice. What we do is we measure...
You have temperature T over T sigma.
Right. So what I said is that's the temperature we measure in the magnetic trap before we transfer into the lattice. So we measure that by measuring the condensate fraction. We've checked that for most of our data, the condensate fraction, once we transfer into the lattice, doesn't change for these shallow lattices at 2 and 6 ER. So that would indicate that it's adiabatic in the sense that T over TC is not changing in the lattice. And so the absolute, and in fact, the external confinement doesn't change much for this kind of data either. So it's about the same absolute temperature in the lattice.
So within this parameters, there's no more insulator?
No. So the data I'm showing you right here, there's no modulator in the cloud at zero temperature. This is all part, this is all in the superfluid part of the phase diagram.
What are the excursions like? I mean, how big are the excursions?
So typical motion in this kind of potential is not too different than this little animation. It's sort of peak amplitude is maybe 10 microns at most. So it's some fraction of the diameter of the cloud.
So when the cloud is moving, the shape is oscillating?
The shape does not really change. So it's really just, you should think of this as center of mass motion. It's the dipole mode, which a lot of us have studied in the magnetic trap and use that for various purposes.
And this cartoon is pretty accurate in terms of the scale of the
curvature? No, it's completely inaccurate in terms of the scale.
So the curvature is very gentle.
The curvature is pretty gentle, yeah.
And it's going many lattice sites.
It's going 10 microns divided by, so maybe 20 lattice sites, 30 lattice sites. So it's in the sense of in movement, it's moving many lattice sites. The center of the cloud is.
So you said the peak, how do you really move the whole cloud in one velocity, I mean all the atoms inside?
Right, so what we do is we apply a force that more or less looks like a uniform force across the cloud. Okay, so we do that by, remember the this external potential is made up of two parts, which are actually centered on each other. So it's made up of, and for this kind of data, the data I was showing you, they have about equal curvatures. There's a part from the magnetic trap, and a part from the optical dipole trap formed by the lattice beams. So you add them together in quadrature to get the total curvature. Okay, and so what we do is we actually take the part that's from the magnetic trap and we displace the potential relative to the cloud. So here's the cloud. So what we actually do is shift that part of the potential for a very short period of time, actually so short that the cloud doesn't really move, but it does pick up some velocity, it moves a little bit. So it looks like an impulse, just like the old impulse theorem we learned as an undergraduate, right? So now it has some momentum, and then we shift it back before it really starts moving much. So it really looks like it starts from the minimum of the potential. The sort of initial condition is minimum of the potential and some amount of velocity.
what's the oscillation frequency?
So typical oscillation frequencies are, you can sort of read it off this graph. I mean, they range between 20 and 35 hertz.
And those colored pictures are after the expansion.
It's after the expansion. So we actually fit these. When we can see a thermal cloud at the coldest temperatures I'm going to show you, we can't really see the motion of the thermal cloud. But we fit this to a bimodal distribution, and we can extract the motion of the center of the so basically with the center of mass motion of the condensate and the thermal cloud is separately.
And if you look at the temperature based on the condensate fraction, it's
exactly
different.
Yeah.
But the temperature, that 0.93 is before you put the lattice.
That's before, but when we can see the thermal cloud in the lattice, it's not really any different as far as we can tell. So it really does look like adiabatic transfer. In fact, we have a lot of interesting data that I'm not going to tell you about today. We can get the effective mass out of this kind of data. We can see effective interactions on the effective mass. We can see all kinds of very interesting things that we have not really dealt with yet.
This oscillation is velocity already larger than critical velocity, obviously.
Well, that's an interesting question. Let me tell you some more, a bit of a story. Actually, is Anatoly Pokovnikov here? Is he not arrived yet? Is anyone, I don't know him, and I want him to actually, okay. All right, anyway, so one thing you notice is that we fit this data to some kind of model to extract things like the frequency and the damping rate. Okay, so what model do we use? Well, this.
Can I ask, how many atoms in the cloud?
So it's different across all the data I'm about to show you. This is really just representative data. Here it's about, this data was about 200,000 atoms in the condensate. The thing I want to call a condensate.
So what's the fraction of the condensate? The condensate fraction?
Oh, in that data it was probably about, 20%, 10%, something like that. But we're going to take data, we're going to vary the temperature wildly of this cloud. And I'm about to show you sort of data across a wide range of temperatures. Okay, that's one thing we're going to change. The two things we're going to change are the lattice depth, so how deep the lattice is, and then also the temperature. We're going to see what happens. Okay, so you notice we fit this. So all the motion we see seems to be very well described by damped harmonic motion. Okay, so we treat the motion of the center of mass coordinate as a damped harmonic oscillator, so we fit it to a model that looks like this, where there's an effective mass, there's a restoring force from the harmonic potential, okay, so F equals minus kz, and there's something that looks like a friction force. This is the friction force here, and you know, we first started thinking about this, we said, friction force is not too uncommon, you can think about something like a Drew model of resistance, which of course is wrong, but it at least gives you an idea of how a friction force can arise. It looks just like the friction force we see here, you know, in that kind of simplistic, overly simplistic and wrong model of resistance in a metal. What you do is you pretend the electrons are moving and they hit scattering centers, and every time they scatter, their velocity stops and then starts again. So their change in momentum is mv, and then it happens with some characteristic scattering time, and then we get some resistance, which is the mass divided by density times the charge times some scattering time. Okay, so we imagine that this friction force that we see is a lot like resistance in a metal. And in fact, it really is just the analog of electrical resistance in this system. And the reason the motion actually damps away is because it's not like a metal where you apply some electric field and there's always a uniform force on the atoms. Here, the force on the atoms that drives the motion really depends on how far up this potential they get. And so because of the way the system arranges itself, the motion eventually decays away, but still, this is really like the analog of electrical resistance. Okay, so you don't get a persistent current like you would in a metal if you apply a voltage to it.
But what do you think? What's acting as dissipation?
Yeah, good question. So let me tell you one other thing we sort of assume in our model is Bloch's theorem. So this should be pretty good in the superfluid part of the phase diagram. We really pretend like the particle is moving back and forth in a band. This is the ground state band in the system and kind of a local density approximation. Here's the energy versus quasi-momentum. The band curvature, of course, gives you the effective mass, and the frequency of motion in this band really comes from that external confinement. Okay, so you can imagine the quasi-momentum is going back and forth in the band. The sort of normal dynamical or mean field instability lies up at 2.6 millimeters per second. That's when you get pi over 2 phase winding in the order parameter between adjacent lattice sites. And we're well away from that. Okay, so sort of set up.
Yeah, I'm always confused with this. If you have optimal lattice, you have Bloch's theory. Now you have a confinement.
Right.
You have a confinement. So it's really not the periodic.
Yeah, so the way people think about this, the way I like to think about it, is kind of in a local density approximation. The reason I think this works well is because the length scales of the external confinement and the lattice are so separated, right?
Okay.
Right? So it's really like, yeah, because my picture was really very wrong.
Okay.
It's more like something like this.
Okay.
So you have a cloud like this, and over any length scale that the density changes, there's many, many, many lattice sites. So we really think about this in a local density approximation, where at each point in space there's some kind of band structure. And so we sort of imagine some picture like this.
So you are treating the whole cloud as just one mass?
You treat the whole cloud as a single particle?
This whole cloud has both condensate and non-condensate.
Right, so what I'm about to show you, in fact, we have not yet completely analyzed and looked at very carefully the motion of this thermal component. All the data I'm about to show you is just for the motion of the condensate. So I might like to think about this as kind of a two-fluid system.
But they might also oscillate.
Might oscillate through each other. So let me show you some interesting things. We see different regimes of different physics, because we take data down to the point where there's only 3% thermal fraction, and we see. Let me show you. All right. Let me just show you the data. So this is what everyone wants to see. Okay. So here is the damping rate we measure at two different lattice depths versus the inverse temperature. The reason I want to show you the data this way is for sort of an obvious old reason, which they want to fit it to some kind of model of thermally activated damping. Mm-hmm. And I know it's a little funny to use T over TC here, but really TC doesn't change much across this data. This is the most convenient way to plot it. So, okay. This is all kinds of the interesting things we see. 2ER, 6ER, we see basically the same kind of behavior, where it looks like if we go to very, very low temperature, this is very low temperature. This is we had to work very hard to get this data. This is 97% condensate fraction before we transfer into the lattice. So this is T over TC of 0.3. Okay, so the first thing you notice is that the damping rate does not really seem to decrease much as we go to lower and lower temperature. This is T over TC of about 0.6. In fact, it fits very well to this kind of model of thermally activated dissipation, where there's, so we fit, this is a solid line here, this is fit, okay, and we can extract from this some kind of energy gap. And some kind of zero temperature damping rate, and we see that, in fact, what we observe is some kind of zero temperature damping, which is not very, which is very inconsistent with zero damping, zero dissipation. Now, so you were asking first about basically about what's like mutual friction observed in superficial helium, or second sound.
Which
sort of I didn't really understand until I started talking to people that the sort of mutual friction observed in the superfluid helium is not really understood. As far as I can tell, it's still put in as something completely phenomenological. Okay, so first off, so as far as I can tell, though, if you look at models, maybe someone can disabuse me of this notion as well. If you look at sort of the understanding of mutual friction in superfluid helium, I thought that where mutual friction comes from in that system is still put in by hand, more or less. Is that true? Can people tell me?
That's what I was asking. That's the height of the potential in units of the recoil energy.
Right.
Is that what that means?
Yeah. But maybe I'm wrong about that. So let me just tell you a few things.
So there's an effect, presumably, that even though you start out at a very low temperature, when you transfer into the lattice, that you don't. The new effective temperature is not as low as you started?
Well, as far as we can tell up to here, it is. We have trouble seeing the thermal fraction in the lattice at all. So as far as we can tell across all this data, up to this part of the data, in fact, the condensate fraction in the lattice is basically the same. And for these lattice steps, I think no one would predict that you could not transfer in adiabatically in the sense that T over TC would not change.
So this is just fit the condensate part to get this guy.
Right, exactly. So as far as we can tell, this sort of extrapolation to zero temperature is working pretty well. We can't see the condensate fraction increase at all on the lattice once we go into the lattice here. It is true that TC is changing a little bit, but not much, in fact. TC is changing a little bit because the overall external confinement is changing. So that's why we plot versus this, not versus absolute temperature.
What is the insulator? Is it like 20 or something, or 10?
Insulator, so from kind of strong coupling expansion calculations, it's a 12.3. So we're well away from any kind of zero temperature insulated behavior. One thing you notice is that, so we exclude this data point at very high temperature from this fit to this kind of thermally activated damping model. And indeed, the damping rate here seems to increase super exponentially. It's increasing very rapidly here. But all this data fits very well to sort of this kind of model.
Question? I mean, I would think you have a single particle interacting with a bunch of quarks.
Right.
I mean, quarks not really linear.
Right.
But so have you tried to feed the damping like a power law instead of exponential form?
Yeah, it's definitely not a power law. Uh-huh. It does not fit well at all. I mean, the comment I make too about mutual friction effects is that this extrapolation we're trying to do to zero temperature, where we cool to very, very low temperature, is working. You know, any kind of mutual friction effect should vanish at zero temperature, since the condensate fraction should go to one.
You could have like T to the fourth power law.
It really, really does not look like a power law. I mean, if you put this on a log-log scale, it's not a power law. It's really curvy on a log-log scale.
Because you're not supposed to have a gap for the known energy excitations.
Yeah, right. Well, let me show you sort of what we think is what might be going on here.
Size of the inputs, you vary that at all? Was what you see linear in that?
We can. So we have changed the impulse. What we see is that for low enough impulse, it doesn't really seem to matter. I mean, what I point out here is that the velocity is not fixed, right? So what we see, and we see this in basically all the data, is it really looks like the velocity just kind of damps away to zero. So, I mean, yes, you know, we can vary this initial maximum velocity here by varying the impulse, and as we go to lower and lower impulse, it doesn't really seem like the damping rate changes at all. If we go to very, very strong impulse, it does. But also, if we go to very strong impulse, we see non-exponential behavior, and I can show you an example of that. At low enough impulse, it always looks like it fits very well to this damped harmonic oscillator, where it really looks like, you know, damps away to zero. There's a very exponential behavior for that envelope of the velocity.
And the rate doesn't change.
It changes a little bit if we change, but the problem is, so in the regime of this kind of initial maximum velocity, the damping rate doesn't change at all. If we increase it, what we see in the beginning is we see non-exponential damping, so fast non-exponential damping, and we can have a problem fitting that to any kind of model. So if we fit all the data to a model that looks just like this, we see different damping rate, but it's kind of a red herring. If we exclude the initial part of the velocity and just fit the tails, and nothing really looks, just fit the long time data, it doesn't really look like anything's changing. And there's probably a reason for that. The reason I was hoping that Anatoly was here is all this data fits very well to a phase-slip model of dissipation, actually. And the phase-slip rate depends very strongly on the velocity.
So phase-slip, you mean this dissipation is due to phase-slip?
Well, it's consistent with that model.
So that's due to vortices. Phase-slip is due
to vortices. So let me show you what that's consistent with. So probably everyone here knows much better than me the sort of story of facelifts and superfluid helium. And then maybe facelifts also kind of describe what's happening in these 1D nanowires for some of this kind of data. So everyone here probably knows this much better than I do. I don't know what happened to the font there. But let me tell you one sort of what. Okay.
But the US is in three dimensions.
Yeah, but the cloud has an edge. So the fate, the phase slip activation barrier is zero at the edge of the condensate. So okay, there's a story of phase slips, right? So does everyone here know what the story of phase slips is? Probably everyone. Okay, so let me tell you. So we got into taking all this data, in fact, by accident. All right, so we started seeing that at very low temperature, we were doing some other measurement. We saw at very, very low temperatures, like this temperature, we saw this dipole mode, or this center of mass motion, always seemed to die away, which we really found surprising, right? I mean, it is kind of surprising, which is why we pursued this and took all this data. And we started talking to people around Urbana who told us about the story of facelifts. All right, so what's the story of facelifts? It's been used to describe other systems. All right, so right, we have an order parameter which describes this cloud, this BEC. That order parameter has some kind of phase, and if there's center of mass velocity, what it means is that phase is winding across the cloud. Okay, so there's some phase gradient across the cloud. So far, so good. All right, so the story of phase slopes is that what can happen in some systems, and usually you don't think about this happening in 3D, is that a vortex or a vortex ring can nucleate, inside the cloud. All right, so here's pictures from Eric's group of some vortex frames. This is from quite a while ago. And actually, Brian Anderson now is seeing vortices, nucleate, and DECs without rotation. Here's a picture of one of Brian's vortices. Okay, so what that does is if a vortex moves across the cloud, that's the usual picture in 1D systems as it moves, and it moves across. Probably what's happening here is that a vortex ring is nucleated in the cloud and it expands and hits the edge of the cloud. Is it wipes out some of this phase winding. So this is a movie that my friend Paul Gobar gave to me. So here's a picture of the phase winding in the cloud. So this is a picture of sort of the order parameter in the cloud, the phase of the order parameter winding around, okay, along the direction of motion. Okay, so actually this is, I think, the order parameter on a polar plot, all right? So the length of this vector is actually the length of the order parameter, and then the phase is where it points in the, along the, in the plane. Make sense? And this is the direction of propagation.
But a Lanz model is like just you have a, like a kink.
Yeah, you have a kink. So what would happen if a vortex crosses a cloud or nucleates in the cloud is something like this, where some of the phase winding is actually wiped out. Mm-hmm. And it takes out 2 pi of that phase winding across the cloud, and now you're at lower velocity than you were before. Okay, so for this kind of process, what I've learned, this is something I didn't know about, is you have this kind of picture of a free energy surface for the system. Okay, so here's like a free energy for the system versus velocity. Of course, the real ground state is at zero velocity. And so there's some, the system has some overall tilt or really some curvature, which is the kinetic energy, all right? So the system would always like to lower its velocity, to lower its kinetic energy and go towards the ground state. And the thing that prevents this is some kind of activation barrier, and that activation barrier comes from the activation barrier for nucleating a vortex or a vortex ring. And where that comes from is actually to have a vortex, right? You have to pull atoms out of the condensate. So there's the energy of the system actually has to go up. So here's this activation barrier added on top of this overall tilt or curvature from the kinetic energy. And so there's 2 ways that the system can go through this activation barrier to get to lower velocity. Either the system can tunnel through the activation barrier, or there can be thermally activated hopping across the activation barrier. So these 2 processes can actually allow the system to go down, which is metastable because of this activation barrier, and reach the ground state. So that's this picture of phase loops. Does that make sense?
So do you also see like plateaus when you plot the?
No, we don't really see plateaus. And So the thing that's kind of funny in the system, and I think what makes this much, the first thing you want to say is, well, this is like a 3D system, so how do you really get phase loops? Why does this act as a dissipation source? I think in this, the thing that you have to realize here is that the harmonic potential, the external potential, is playing a very, very large role. And the role it's playing that's important to the dissipation is, in fact, giving the cloud an edge, because the activation barrier for these phase loops is 0 at the edge, right? There's no density there. And so kind of the picture that Eugene Demler and I are thinking is happening here now is that there's phase loops, kind of vortices or phase kinks happening very easily at the edge of the cloud. And this is what's giving rise maybe to the dissipation. And so the question is, if that's true, can we test a couple things in the that we see against a model of phase loops, right? And so Anatoly and Eugene and Misha Lukin have a paper out now which has a bunch of predictions about phase loops.
But wouldn't the vortex field move across the cloud to have phase change?
Yeah, the other thing that could happen is you could have a vortex ring which nucleates right basically the surface of the cloud and expands to the edge. And that would also take out 2 pi phase winding.
Usually there's some barrier it has to overcome.
Right.
To do that.
Yeah, that's right.
Spread out over the entire cloud.
Right.
Maybe the story is near the edge. The condensate, the temperature may not be uniform. Near the edge, the temperature is already above the TC. Then below TC, you can only get a vortex anti-vortex pair. So they will not cause any linear dissipation.
Yeah, so
only near the edge, you need to isolate. To cause dissipation, you need isolated vortices.
So maybe people can help me understand. Right. So. Maybe people here can help me understand this kind of, the usual note, the thing I hear from people in Urbana without a very clear explanation is that people often think of vortices as being bound, coming in vortex and anti-vortex pairs,
yeah.
So this can't give rise to dissipation. So I don't actually understand that.
maybe near the edge, I don't know. I just get near the edge, maybe something happens, so they.
The thing that's funny about vortices in this system is that, you know, they can annihilate with anti-vortices at the edge of the cloud. Yeah. And so, for example, Brian Anderson's experiment, they've seen in a non-rotating cloud nucleation of odd numbers of vortices, right? Which you'd originally think is sort of strange, but the fact is things can nucleate near the edge, and one part of a pair can annihilate right away with an anti-vortex which lives outside the cloud.
It's not any different from a bucket of helium 4. We have that too. Most typical vortex processes are involved in nucleating at the edge and moving across.
I see. So that's true.
So it's normal.
That is.
Nothing unusual about it.
Okay. So I haven't had anyone tell me that yet. So that's. I see.
I think probably all the dissipation come from the edge, as you said.
But they still have to sweep across the sample. In bulk, you would think that the intermediate state, the sub-intermediate state, where your vortex ring is, has a length, the length of the vortex line is aborted the length of the sample. Mm-hmm. So the cost of energy, which is aborted that length.
Right. I'd agree.
In a big sample, that's big.
Right.
And it doesn't matter that there's an edge, because it has to get across a sample in order to actually create a facelift.
I see.
The effect, the damping gets to be exponential in the energy.
Well, the different kind of processes that could be happening. So there's a thermally activated ones where you're using temperature to overcome that barrier, and that you would expect to give some thermally activated contribution, but then the energy should
with very
scale
large
with the size of your cloud properties like superfluid density, etc.
I see. That's true.
Then at very low temperature, maybe there's some, some kind of tunneling.
Right, and
that also usually scales with size.
Right.
To get through a higher, deeper barrier.
Right. Yeah, I would expect that. So we haven't checked scaling with size of kind of the activation barrier yet. But
gamma zero also. Some systematic way. Of course, everything depends on the size of your cloud.
Yeah, so we haven't checked scaling it with the size of the cloud, which is an interesting idea. We've checked scaling with the Bose-Hubbard parameters, which I can show you. That's why we're fitting into this model of some kind of thermally activated process, right? Because what you expect from this kind of generic behavior, regardless of where the activation barrier comes from, is that there's some regime of very low temperature, which is dominated by quantum tunneling of facelifts, and then there's some high temperature regime where you have some thermally activated process. So that's why we fit it to this. And that's sort of one piece of evidence we think is consistent with some kind of model of facelifts, is you see this kind of crossover behavior from something at low temperature, which seems temperature independent, more or less.
Well, just means some activated process is contributing.
Right.
To connect it to facelifts, that's it.
Well, okay, so the reason, the other piece of evidence we have that it is connected to facelifts is sort of how it scales with the Bose-Hubbard model parameters, so T over U, tunneling interaction energy. So in this paper I was mentioning by Anatoly and Ehud and Eugene and everyone else, what they predict in there is that the facelift rate, and therefore the sort of damping rate in the quantum tunneling regime, is proportional to E to the minus square root T over U. Okay, so it's not surprising to see T over U somewhere in this, right? Because it's how you put together some kind of dimensionless parameter. But the square root here is something which is, I don't know where else that comes from. So what we thought about doing is try to figure out what was going on here is look for this kind of scaling behavior. So in fact, we see it.
Another question? How does the have you measured the condensate fraction?
Right.
As a function of time.
Yeah, so we don't see the
condensate. The loss of the condensate.
Right. We see that the condensate fraction does go down a little bit in some data, although it doesn't seem to matter whether or not we give the cloud an impulse. So it's not surprising that there's something like three-body recombination happening. In fact, that there's something like 3 atoms per lattice site in the densest data. So we do see that there's a little bit of loss of condensate fraction, but it's not huge.
But not compared to this kind of gamma, this kind of rate.
No, not compared to that. It's very slow, and it happens not in all the data. And we have a hard time seeing it sometimes.
Okay.
So in this calculation, do they take care of the trap and the edge?
No, they don't really take into account the trap. So in this calculation, they really assume a homogeneous system. That's right.
But what kind of velocities are you, what are your peak velocities compared to if you convert it into
phase? About half that. So about, if you ask what's the, so the velocity, right, so if you have a velocity, what's the velocity associated with pi over 2 phase
right,
winding per
right.
light?
What is that?
We're about half of that at our maximum velocity. Okay.
So what's the typical value of this theory? Compared to the
Okay, so this is square of T over U, so you can square it to figure out what T over U is. Okay, so so I don't know, 0.9 squared is about 0.9 is 81, 0.81 is about 1, down to 0.2 squared, 0.2 times 0.2, 0.1. Okay, so we did not actually sort of set out to find phase lifts. What we saw was this sort of zero temperature dissipation that we could never see go away. So we asked ourselves, what does it do? And then this idea of phase lifts came up. So this is the other piece of evidence we have that may be related to phase lifts. So this is a damping rate versus square root T over U. So on a log Lin scale, you should get a line if you see this kind of scaling. And that's what we see. These are two temperatures. These are two pretty cold temperatures, so two temperatures you might expect if it is phase lifts where you're dominated by quantum phase lifts. What we see is a really nice scaling. The slope of the line hasn't changed, although the offset is different between the two. Okay, so that's one piece of information. So do you have any comments on that? Questions?
It's probably not fair to ask you about the theory you're quoting.
You can. I try to understand as much of it as I can.
What are they actually calculating when they talk about phase slip rate?
Right. So my understanding of what they're calculating is that...
just what's a physical situation? So you said there's no trap. You have
right.
bosons and a periodic potential.
Right.
3D.
They do a calculation for 1D, 3D, 1D, 2D, 3D. They do the Bose-Hermer model, but they do it in the limit of infinite number of particles per site. So they transform into the quantum rotor model, which is a little bit wrong.
This I don't, that's even more detailed. You start off with a superfluid with some initial velocity, and you just ask, you say...
They ask the question at fixed velocity, what's the phase look rate? And they do this calculation...
What does that mean? So but do they talk about the decay rate for the velocity? Is that what they talk about or not?
Yes. Basically, what they talk about literally is a phase slip rate, and then they assume that you take out 2 pi per length of the sample times h over n, the velocity per phase slip. They also do a calculation where they actually they look at a system like this, although they do something which would be hard to do in a real experiment, which is to change just u, and then see what happens to the motion.
But so there's no dependence.
They do a calculation.
No dependence on the sample geometry in there?
So what they find, so they change the sample geometry in the sense of doing 1D, 2D, 3D.
Yeah.
Right.
And so let's say 2D or 3D, does the dimension of the sample come in?
Yeah, it comes in basically to the slope for what the scaling should be. So if you look, they have some, what they literally write down is something like, it comes in two ways. They literally write down something like this. Some power. There's some thing here. I don't see this. So what they literally write down is a phase slip rate. They don't tell you what the proportional active factor is out here. Okay, they don't calculate this. I understand there's some history you're trying to understand this. They look at only velocities near the sort of what you call the dynamical or mean field instability, okay, which also doesn't describe our system particularly well. The dimension of...
Really? Okay. So they're not talking about relaxation for very small velocities.
No, they're not.
They're looking here.
They're looking here.
It's like right over here.
Right. So okay. Talking to Eugene...
I don't need to know anything. Thanks.
Okay. The other thing we did is we did look in the regime where there should be mod insulator in the cloud. So these are just pictures showing you that we see sort of the same kind of thing that Block and Marcus Greiner saw, where if we look at just the momentum distribution, we see something happening going to a localized state. So we call this one insulator. The instead shows data which is for lattice states greater than 12, greater than or equal to 12. So strong coupling expansion experiments in this system say that we should see the tip of the sort of n equals 1 mod insulator load is at a lattice depth of 12.3, and that's about this point right here. This line is this linear fit extrapolated into this regime. We don't see any enormous spectacular change when mod insulators should emerge in the cloud, although these points generally lie systematically higher than this line. So what's happening here is somewhere up here, these points are coming off of this line, but there's nothing extremely dramatic that happens. Comments, questions? So what's next? So next I was just going to put my conclusions up, but I mean, the reason I brought this up here is to see what everyone thinks about it. And this is something, this is a topic I'm learning about now that I don't know a whole lot about.
Do you think there's any reason why a theory developed for velocities near the critical velocity should apply to your data, which you seem to say is in linear response?
Right. So I mean, I asked Eugene Demler about this and asked him, why should we listen to your theory? Why should we expect the scaling so far away? You know, in particular, you never expect from this kind of theory that the velocity even should ever go away completely to zero, right? His comment was that he thought that the square root T over U scaling was fairly generic. Okay, so that in any, for reasons that I don't understand, he thought that any model involving phase lifts here would see a square, would see this kind of scaling in the system for the phase lifter dissipation rate. Okay. That's about it. It's because Eugene Demler said so.
That can be true.
You know, they can't understand all the theory. Are there any comments or questions? It would be very useful to us at this point to try to understand what's happening here.
Can I clarify a question to get them?
Yeah.
What is depth is the depth of
the size
of single?
No, not quite. So AML people do something funny in these systems. So right, we make this the lattice potential. This is something I find confusing. I don't know why people do this. So actually, the one well is 3 times deeper than that number.
And so if you, as the lattice depth is reduced to zero,
right,
you can do it. What, you still have the
depth? No, it's, so one does not expect this kind of dipole moment or the center of mass motion to dampen a purely harmonic potential. This comes from the so-called Cohen's theorem. And indeed, that's seen, we see that, everyone's always seen that.
So you need single vacuum in the lattice in order to, okay, one of the reasons to deviate from quadratic potential.
Right.
You can deviate in other ways. So that was my question. So if I don't have single particle,
right,
don't have lattice,
right,
I do something to the potential.
Right.
Right. I can change slope, I can add linear piece somewhere.
You can't really add a linear piece.
Okay. Okay. And it's a measurement from X squared.
Right.
And have condensate, and they'll still will have expected some dampening to occur, which will not involve T over U at all, because they're not there.
Well, I mean, there is a very general result that in a pure harmonic, okay, so yeah, anything but
myself, I mean, I understand.
Yeah. Right.
So if potential, confined potential is not strictly harmonic.
Right,
so
that's true.
Yes.
Right, but we can check that somehow sort of anharmonicity is not playing a role here, because what we can do is we can look at the motion, this motion in the combined dipole and magnetic trap without the lattice potential present.
Yes.
Yeah, and we don't see any dampening. So we can turn off the lattice potential in the easiest way just by blocking one set of beams. And we can then crank up the light very high to get the equivalent dipole chart for this kind of data. We don't see any damping in that kind of situation. So it's not due to intermittencies.
So you they do just you goes forever
so we get tired of measuring it. So the specific statement is across this kind of free evolution time, we see damping in the system with zero.
So this is a three-dimensional optical lens.
3D optical lens.
So what if you plot your curve to the region T is greater than U to the right? What happens?
T greater than U. So the problem is that the tight bind. So this is about the biggest T over U where the tight binding model makes any sense. So saying what U is gets a little confusing off here. So this is small, so less at the 4. Tight binding model is pretty good, although if you calculate the effective mass, you get some number that's a little bit less than 1.
So this is always in a strongly interacting region?
Yeah, strongly interacting, but this data is away from where there should be any mod insulator in the cloud at zero temperature. So does anyone else have thoughts about what else could be going on here? Other kind of data we can take to sort of sort the situation out? I mean, as I said, we sort of have this picture that maybe it's consistent. You know, our main statement is that we see what looks like what we normally call metal. So as we go to lower and lower temperature, we see some kind of dissipation, which is
just in a super fluid region, the gamma node sphere. This pattern is in the super fluid region.
Yeah, which is why we found it very strange.
But then another graph you showed is in a water insulated region. Right?
That's the data we insert here.
This is a multi-insulator.
Well, here we're looking only at the superfluid component. Remember, it's not the system because of the external confinement. You have coexisting superfluid and non-insulated phases.
Oh.
Right.
So this here where you need very it's very small, right? Here we go to the.
This is a line of 16. So this is there's quite a lot of non-insulator, but there's also still a lot of superfluid left.
Oh, I see.
Right, because remember
you always have superfluid.
You always have superfluid. Remember,
super component.
Yeah, remember what you actually do in these systems is you, if this is a zero temperature phase diagram, I'll draw the mean field kind of picture, right? What you're actually doing is you're drawing some kind of line on here, right? So even in very deep lattices, there's always some superfluid present. So we're looking at just the motion of the superfluid part. You don't see the non-insulator part moves at all. Perhaps not surprising.
But do you see this cake structure? That's deep in there.
Well, I mean, to see this cake structure, so you'd have to go and do these kinds of measurements that Wolfgang Kerley and Lena Block have done, some sort of spectroscopic test of it. But yeah.
What's the feeding factor?
So in the middle of the lattice, it's all the data. The highest for the high sensitivity data, it's 3 per site.
3 per site.
Right.
But when you go to the edge, then it's, the feeling factor changes.
Oh yeah, it's zero somewhere.
Then it must be always superfluid component. It's always a superfluid.
Yeah, at the edge, there's always, one would say there's always superfluid there. Uh-huh. At the very boundary of the cloud. Yeah.
Is the connection of your studies to Heinrich Moritz and stuff?
I don't know what you're talking about.
You also displace a lattice and watch damped oscillations.
When was this?
There was a talk on it at the March meeting.
Maybe I'm not sure.
I think they don't do the velocity impulse. They actually displace the.
Right. I mean, so then, for example, the NIST Gibbsberger did this. 2001, 2002, with 1D tubes with a lattice along the tube.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but that was even early. Yeah,
they saw some strange things.
I think actually I can't solve why the screws, because the superfluid velocity is always proportional to the screw root of T times U.
Superfluid velocity is proportional. What do you mean the superfluid square root of T times U? I can make the superfluid velocity.
I just did a little calculation that is always true. In the strong carbon region, particularly.
You mean the critical velocity? That way you calculate the critical?
No, just the phonon velocity.
The phonon velocity? It's for T times U.
Yes. I mean, times out of like A or something else.
Right.
Only depends on T, that's where the screw is.
Right, but you said it's T times U, not T.
Well, that's the velocity, so it must be divided by some any.
This is a little bit like numerology.
Must come with the screw root. That's the.
Okay, I can perhaps.
Maybe that comes square.
No, because
yeah. Okay, you got one dimensionless parameter.
Because the energy is linear in the V.
And I remember what was, they were able to do it for a system with a flashback resonance, mm-hmm. and in a lattice, so they would see these oscillations, but then they would quickly put the system in, they would see oscillations by tuning the system first to a place where scattering length is actually zero,
okay.
and then it would get, and then you would get oscillations
right.
with a pretty large Q, and then it would go to a regime where it has a large A, and then those oscillations would, you know, instead be over there.
This is in a lattice?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Whose group is this?
I don't know how to pronounce it. Heinrich Moritzen?
Oh, so that's, you mean Henning Moritz? Moritz?
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it.
That's Tim Tillman's group. I think someone's been interested in this, but I didn't know that he sort of had a result.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'm trying to find the paper.
Okay.
Did you say that so the velocity is actually below the critical velocity?
Well, so I mean, what someone like Eugene would say is that the critical velocity here
is very small, maybe due to the
so energy. Yeah. So due to the interaction. So his prediction is actually due to the interactions. So he would say this is basically okay. What he does in his paper is he says that there's some sort of action up here in this exponent. Right, this is like an action.
No, I'm asking a different question. Just want to check, and then is your the maximum velocity?
Mm-hmm. So what you usually call
is below the critical velocity of a uniform.
Okay, so the critical velocity of a uniform superfluid, I think, is very small. But that's the way I understand that is the critical velocity for taking something. It would be like for moving a laser, taking a laser beam and poking it through the cloud, and superfluid helium for taking a cylinder or ball and dragging it through. That's very low. This is somehow.
For large U is not small.
I mean, I just told you.
Yeah.
According to the fluid
you. So you say for large U it gets.
Yeah, large U is better.
Okay. But I'm not sure that kind of critical velocity is really relevant to an experiment like this, where you talk about the critical velocity for dragging something through the superfluid. Right. For single particles in a lattice, I mean, there's. Because of Bloch's theorem, these things can just move freely. I mean,
there can be some dynamic instabilities.
Right, so that's at a very large velocity compared. That's twice the maximum velocity you have. This kind of dynamical instability you usually talk about. And I would call that like the mean field instability.
But with the strong interaction,
right.
And that can be depressed quite,
right.
quite a bit.
Right, and so. What I was saying
is I just don't remember how the curve in this paper by
it's
Altman.
It's this paper, actually, where they
yeah, that's right. No?
Yes. Well, they have a four-page version.
No, there's a three-author paper.
Yeah, they have a four-page version of this paper where they talk about sort of critical velocity. But what they mean by a critical velocity is kind of a funny thing. It's actually where this action becomes comparable to one. I mean, they don't.
Increases as a density.
Yeah, it's one over the.
So they don't talk about a critical velocity.
Maybe
sort of the usual sense. It's really just
like to check with you about the scale.
Yeah,
how does your velocity compare to those?
Right. So up in here at these kinds of lattice steps, the maximum velocity we have is bigger than that critical velocity.
I see.
But that critical velocity, like I said, is just a velocity where they say the phase slip rate becomes not small. Okay. And that phase slip, what that really means is the action up inside this exponential is something like one.
Does that expression only work for V logic and V naught?
Oh, it's for V. Oh, I probably wrote this wrong, but it's V a little bit smaller than whatever V naught is, or whatever this critical velocity is.
That power, what's that power percent?
I forget what this is, but this depends on dimension.
It's not,
I think it's maybe D minus 2 or something like this. I can't remember. Or, I don't know, absolute value of D minus 2, maybe something like this. I can't remember exactly. I have the paper we can look through.
Sorry, Brian, I take it back. This was, you were looking at fermions and both Fermi matches, but
right.
not on the superfluid.
Yeah. Right.
So just, yeah, simple.
Right. Well, fermions. Okay, so.
Maybe you show us the conclusion?
Yeah, so our conclusion is not. Okay, so what we would say is we see that in this, the model that describes this system, and I think, again, the external confinement here is really, really, really important. We see something like what you normally call metallic behavior in an Akinetz matter system, in the sense we see dissipation, which doesn't vanish at zero temperature. At least the data are consistent with a model that has dissipation, which does not vanish at zero temperature. And that's that thermally activated model we fit the data to. We see this sort of qualitative agreement with the face-slope model, but then we actually have very terrible quantitative agreement with that calculation, although the calculations are wrong in a lot of ways. So this zero temperature damping rate we see and the energy gap and that slope are actually, none of them agree with the theory, but the theory is really wrong in a lot of ways. The theory is done for a homogeneous system, it's done for the mapping to a quantum rotor model, and it's done at fixed velocity. So, sorry, I shouldn't say the theory is wrong, but the theory is a lot different than the experiment. So those are kind of our conclusions.
So this phase is not a homogeneous phase. It's not calling a phase because it's a...
Yeah, actually, it means
everything. Everything you could possibly be talking about.
I don't need to write this here. Actually, what I meant to say is it shows metallic behavior. So in the sense that it shows dissipation, which doesn't seem to vanish at zero temperature.
It's not a uniform phase.
That's true, but I shouldn't have put this up here. This is not what I actually meant to write. I meant to write, what this should read is, shows metallic behavior. Okay, let's rewrite it that way. All right. Okay, whether or not this is phase-slopes, it's kind of hard to say. As I said, we see sort of this qualitative agreement with what you expect from phase-slopes, but it could be something else. There's just no other model yet. No other physics anyone's proposed to me that can explain it.
But I missed it. So this data is for a 3D system?
It's for 3D free lattice, yeah.
Then it's fairly, isotropic? Or?
Yeah, it's pretty spherical. It's, for the shallow lattices, there is a weak direction, and the weak direction is 8% of the geometric mean of the oscillator frequencies. By this sort of 6ER, where we have a lot of data, it's the 8 spheres, the sort of asymmetry is 2% measured in that way. So it's pretty spherical. But I think it doesn't really matter because we just excite the motion along one direction, which seems to be very harmonic.
Well, if the dissipation is due to excitation vortices
right.
The age, I think that will manifest in the loss of the condensate fraction as well.
Right. Right.
But the fact that your condensate fraction doesn't really
It does decay.
But compared to your damping of the velocity.
Yeah, sure.
It's hard to measure condensation fraction. How do you measure condensation fraction?
Well, no, we can measure it pretty accurately just from these images. So we do see decay of condensate fraction. So, my question is sort of... one thing I'd like to understand is how... So, for example, could you do a really simple calculation to estimate if you see this amount of velocity across the cloud, this amount of phase winding across the cloud, rather, disappear, how much condensate fraction should you lose? I don't understand how to calculate that. Particularly, this boundary here, the boundary, the edge of the cloud, I think makes the situation hard.
Yeah.
Because so things can happen so easily there. The superfluid fraction is zero. That's why I really think, so I put this statement here. I think this measurement, or at least sort of the picture we're trying to start to build of what's happening here, I think it really highlights the fact that the external confinement can be really, really important. And here, if it's something like facelifts, facelifts can happen very easily at the edge of a cloud.
So, question, when the motion got damped, right, does it cause the heating to the system? Mm-hmm.
If you calculate the amount of energy per particle that there should be because of velocity in decayed, it's pretty small.
But
it would be hard to see it.
Just one comment. Already many of us already suggest probably it's good to measure the gamma as function of the size of the system. Number of particles.
Yeah. Okay. No, we can try that. That's
it's very surprising. Damping with velocity below the critical velocity.
So the main point is just that you have this expectation something like the activation for your facelifts would just get larger the larger the size of the system.
Because several of us already point out maybe due to the edge problems.
It's funny you say edge problems, where I sort of think, okay, the edge is where all the action's happening, that's what sort of makes this interesting and possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think we could ever get, I don't think these experiments can ever get into the regime where the edge is not important.
No, but you'll see they will change.
I mean, okay, so one thing we could try to do is try to do something where.
No, I would say you should be looking for size dependence of the activation barrier, for instance. I mean, if that's a number that you pull out of your fits relatively well.
Yeah.
Add so, gamma zero.
Right. You just, yeah, so I think we'll look for that. I have to think about how much we can really change the size of the cloud in a way that matters.
Well, probably what is it to not go through the fog, just more rather sphere, then travel much easier. Because they need to go through the deep inside the fog, that's because it's high.
So do they to take out a phase winding dope, though, can they just do it by moving around the surface? I think this comment's right, but I have to go through.
If you wanted the phase to slip at some particular point, you need a vortex loop to pass over it.
Right.
Element. Somewhere in the center of the cloud. If that's the kind of picture you're talking about.
Right. So, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I should say this activation barrier that we pull out of this data is pretty large. It's like, I mean, I think it's a micro Kelvin for a micro K for this data, which is a very large energy, actually.
So where does the momentum go? I mean, the lattice.
Right. So I would say it's somehow, I mean, it's dissipated into kinetic energy of the thermal cloud. And that energy is small enough, it would just be hard for us to measure it.
And then your thermal clouds get speed up.
Exactly. Well,
already
not energy.
Momentum. I mean, just low,
right.
This kind of low velocity.
Right. Momentum's not conserved here. That's important to remember. So, I mean, the way I want to look at it is just that the momentum gets diffused as you get momentum diffusion into the thermal cloud. I don't have to have conservation momentum.
Okay.
Right. That's what confinement room is at.
What's the coherence length compared with the
coherence length is shorter than the lattice space connection for most of this data. If you just calculate it and calculate coherence length. Well, okay. So this is our main conclusion from what we see, and then we, as I said, the sort of secondary conclusions where we see this kind of qualitative agreement, quantitative disagreement with this sort of phase-up model of dissipation. Been talking for a while. Let me just tell you one thing that we're working on now that my guys in the lab are setting up right at the moment, and then if people are interested, maybe later we can talk about the sort of quantum mechanism stuff we want to do. So people know there's a lot of interest in kind of a disordered Bose-Hubbard model. Some people use it to describe something like what might be happening in a supercell. This is a picture of Moses Chan's experiment. So what we're going to try to do in our experiment is actually add disorder into the lattice and make a lattice potential, which in fact looks kind of like the one I drew here. So what's special about what we're going to do is the disorder length scale is comparable to the lattice spacing. And we're going to do this in 3D. And right now, we have a model statistics on what the disorder looks like, and I'll show you how we're going to do that. And we're working with David Severly's group to pull out the distributions of what will happen in T and U, the tunneling matrix element, the interaction matrix element. Let me just skip this, so because this is probably wrong. So there are lots of interesting reasons to look at disorder, particularly also to look at transport when there's disorder present. So the way we're going to add disorder is by adding a speckle field. So here's a picture of the actual speckle field that we're going to shine onto the lattice. The way we get this is we take some green light, we shine it through a diffuser. So this is basically a piece of plastic that looks like someone spit on it and scratched it up with their shirt sleeve. We shine it and focus it with a very, very high numerical aperture lens. And here what we did is we put a microscope in to show you this picture. Okay, so here's... taken from this kind of picture, here's the autocorrelation function of this picture. So what this really tells you is something about the characteristic length scale of disorder. And this really is autocorrelation function, the way one would normally describe it. And so what you expect for speckle and what you expect for this kind of disorder is something which looks like a Gaussian, and here the sort of 1 over e squared radius of this is 528 nanometers, so it's pretty comparable to the lattice spacing, which is 406 nanometers. Okay, and we actually will do this in 3D. Here's that kind of size of the autocorrelation function along the position, along the sort of optical axis here that we're focusing along, and across the size of the cloud, this really doesn't change much. So we have really fine grain disorder across the whole cloud. So the way you should think about this is what we're doing is taking a potential and adding it to the optical lattice potential. So we're taking this disordered potential and adding to it. And the way this is really different than what people have done before because the length scale is so small. So I had one of my students do kind of a toy calculation to kind of show you how it is actually different in the sense of being very fine-grained compared to what people have done previously. So again, we're doing have our perfect optical lattice potential or very nearly perfect, and we add in some kind of disordered speckling field. The toy calculation I had them do is calculate if we have let's say a 1 ER shift at this lattice site right here, let's call it lattice site A, at its neighbor, what's the probability distribution of shifts? So the height, probability distributions of height of the disordering potential, where the average here is 5 ER. So here's that probability density at the neighbor versus shift. Okay, so 1 ER here was the shift at the neighbor. So previous work by Alan Spey, for example, and a lot of other places have used speckle fields where the characteristic speckle size is very large, so something like 5 microns. So then basically what you get is you get, if you calculate that probability distribution for getting some shift at the neighbor, well, it's basically the same as whatever you had at the first lattice site. So there's some Gaussian centered on 1 ER. Our speckle field, the speckle size is comparable to the lattice spacing, so that's this blue curve here where you can have a really wide range of shifts at the neighbor. In fact, if you had very, very small speckle size compared to the lattice spacing, you'd have this black curve, which is a very, very soft function of lattice shifts. The lens group, and I know Massimo Guccio talked about what he's doing here, where he adds 1D disorder to one direction of the lattice only. What he did is he's doing that with an incommensurate lattice. So in fact, this is in some sense kind of predictable. You can predict exactly what the shift will be at the neighboring site up to sort of two particular values. And you know, if you think about the characteristic size of his speckle, it's actually quite a bit larger. It's close to 2 microns compared to what we're doing. So this is how what we're going to do is very different. And like I said, we're working with David separately to sort of figure out how to take this distribution of site energies and translate it into distributions and tunneling and interaction energy. It's not a completely straightforward problem. So what we're hoping to do is put some atoms into this potential, look for things like the Bose-Glass phase, or things like the gap to open up between them on insulator phases, on the phase diagram, but also to study transport when disorder is present and see what happens. So it's one thing we're working on now. We hope to actually have preliminary data by DAMOP, which is the first week of June, and I think that can happen. And then this is a long story about what we want to do to simulate quantum magnetism, and I don't really know if you want to listen to that. It's 11:30 already. So you guys tell me what we want.
Okay, and right again.